In the mid-19th, I should say 20th century, Henry Beam was a promising young poet from Cleveland County, went to Duke, earned a fellowship to Paris for more study. He returned with poems that he claimed were saved from a Nazi death camp, but a dispute over the authorship of those poems ruined his career. Beam retreated from public view, but 3 decades later, he opened up to a graduate student telling her about what happened in France. That's the plot of A Stone for Bread, the latest novel from Greensboro writer Miriam Herron. Miriam will be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on November 1st, and she's going to be elsewhere in the area, and you can find out all about it at our website. But first, listen to Miriam here on The State of Things. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us more about this novel. It is a tangled web of relationships in France, but it starts with Henry Beam. Tell us about this guy.
Well, Henry Beam comes, he's sort of a failed poet, and the poems were very controversial, and he left the area. He was living around Durham, and then comes back, and he tells the young woman, Rachel, about his student year in France, where he gets very involved with a right-wing politician. These are the years after World War II. These are in the 1950s. France is in turmoil. A lot of the information is coming out about the Holocaust, some of the French participants in that, and it's sort of a very chaotic time in French politics. And it's really a story of corruption at some level. Henry's a naive young man. He's from the boonies of North Carolina. He comes to France and suddenly discovers people and discovers and he discovers a young woman, and she's connected to this politician. And he tells himself this is the only reason he's coming and working for them some. You know, love does that to you, I guess. And so he really, he falls into a lot of this kind of being used by these people. And he kind of knows he is, but he kind of tells himself, well, maybe I'm going to write a book about this.
Telling himself a story. And the story is about these poems, ultimately. Tell us about the poems and what they purport to be.
The poems are purported to come out of the Mauthausen death camp in Austria, which is one of the worst of Hitler's camps and was the last one liberated. And so, you know, when he comes back to Chapel Hill, but he says they were given to him by a man named Only René. And René, his story is told through the novel, too. And we don't know whether he's a real character or not, or Henry made him up. And so that's sort of part of the story. But he was at the Mauthausen death camp, and supposedly
and now these anonymous poems are given to this mysterious René, who then turns them over to Henry, and now you've got this trove of death camp poems by an anonymous victim of the Holocaust that will later turn out to be exposed as a lie, and Henry's sort of knowledge of this is part of the question. Would you read for us from your book? Would you read for us?
Yes. This is right from the opening. René was 4 years old when he buried a grenade in the garden behind his house. It was the summer of 1917, and there was war in France. Months before, soldiers had bivouacked in a village. When they moved on, René's father went to join the fighting farther north. The boy's grandparents spoke in hushed tones about Les Bouches and guns with names, Big Bertha and Albrecht, and one called the Distant Princess. René heard the booms from his bedroom window. He watched the sky flare with light. One morning, a line of French soldiers passed through the village. That afternoon, his grandfather buried a tin box in a corner of the barn. The barn held coins. The box held coins, a silver vanity set, 2 gold watches, a jewel brooch belonging to a grandmother generations back, medals won by his great-uncle Albert in the war with Prussia. René held the small box while his grandfather dug. He watched him place the box in the hole, tamp down the dirt and cover it with straw and hay bales. The next day, René buried his treasures, bits of metal and colored rock scavenged from the woods. His 12-year-old brother, Etan, found them in the garden a week later when his hoe sliced into the grenade. Etan's arms were blown from his body, and he bled to death quickly. Of course it was an accident. The notary who investigated sadly shook his head and reminded the family it was wartime. A dog could have dragged it in. René wasn't told the notary's explanation. He was, after all, a child, and did not understand why his brother had died. What evil thing waited in ambush among the leafy turnips? Did it, too, have a name? Realization came to him only gradually, the way one's hands go slowly numb with cold.
That's Miriam Heron reading from the opening chapter of her novel, A Stone for Bread. Miriam's going to be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on November 1st, and elsewhere around the area. We have those sites at our website, stateofthings.org. It seems to me that what you've woven together here is this sort of ambiguity in the way we tell ourselves stories. Post-World War II France, where everybody had to dodge the label of collaborator, right? The big fear is that somehow, what was your complicity? And in fact, as people sort of try to remember back, they're not quite sure. Yeah, some people were clearly involved, others not. And then these kind of faux poems that didn't really come from the death camp, all of which, is this a theme that you're going for, this kind of story we tell ourselves that ultimately corrupts our own memory of?
I think, you know, some people say evil is those who commit it are often, it's banal, and that the banality of evil, that we slide into corruption slowly and it's complex. Evil is complex. It's very hard to find total villains, total heroes. And Rene, who thinks he's a villain.
Right, can't get over the guilt of being responsible
for
his brother's death, and yet in many ways not, and others as adults who are complicit in the homicide and the Holocaust in World War II. So when did this plot, does it come together for you as a piece? How did this book come together in your mind?
Well, it's a 20-year-old manuscript.
See.
And which my agent in New York at the time said, no, this isn't going to work. And but the book came together because I felt desperate. I'd already had two books in New York and didn't publish. And so what I felt like that I had to write something, and I was going to write some kind of mystery thriller. And then this image of that four-year-old child came to me. And at that point, it changed the whole book. And everything flowed from that.
How many of the other elements or the characters did you have in place before that galvanizing image?
Well, I thought I'd write about a North Carolina poet and a manuscript that's lost or something, and that was pretty much it. And then everything came from that.
What about the poetry in this book?
Unfortunately, I wrote it. I don't think of myself as a poet, but some of these things just came.
And, do you...
It was a kind of interesting process about that. I mean, the first poem is really one of the poems from Mauthausen that was saved. Mm. And that one is really about two men who are shoveling the refuse from the fires, from the burning of the bodies in the camp. They shoveled them onto the Danube River. And I happened to find about at that time looking for something. What would they talk about? And so what I came up with was that they might be talking about soccer, which they call football, and that I came up with this player, Matthias Sindelar, who was a major soccer player, football player, and who actually was thought he was a Jew. He was not a Jew, but they considered he was a Jew, and who actually died fairly early, just of accidental or... Maybe not.
Yeah. Did you do much research? Did you have to feel that you had to do much research for this book?
I did a lot of research, yes.
Is that what you do? This is your fourth published novel, right?
This is my second.
Second published novel,
yes.
And you have a couple awaiting.
Oh, we hope so. One of these days.
Do you, in your other novels, those that have been published and not, do you do research? Do you like that?
Yes, I enjoy doing research. And it's fun to just sort of find a place and time and then learn about it. And I did. Although I laugh about the book I'm working on now is Seminole Indian War. I say this is my war trilogy. The first novel, Absolution, dealt with Vietnam. This one with World War II.
Is there anything, I wonder if you sort of have these themes in mind, then there are characters, and then you begin to do research, actual historical research. Does the weight of the book change? Does it change the weight you're going to give your characters or the weight that the theme carries in the book when you have actual data to work with?
You know, it's an interesting thing to write fiction. I often think it comes from the gods. And I start, and it comes from character. Mm-hmm. I start with people, and I start with maybe a situation, maybe a question. This time it was with that image of the four-year-old boy. And then somewhere it comes, and it's hard to explain.
What came is the book A Stone for Bread, and my guest is Miriam Herron. She's the author. She'll be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro November 1st, Literary Book Post in Salisbury on the 14th of November, and McIntyre's Books in Pittsboro on November 15th. And if you missed that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Miriam, what a pleasure. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.